Welcome to the Sustainability of Podcast. My name is Amelia, your host, and each week we talk about the sustainability of a topic, industry, or company. We're your one-stop shop for learning about everything sustainability related. Everyone, today I'm excited to be chatting with Lauren Fay, the founder and executive director of the New Fashion Initiative. A sustainable consultant herself, Lauren helped to found the Fashion Revolution USA chapter, which has also seen massive success, and her experience working for them inspired her to create a 501c3 herself. The New Fashion Initiative is a 501c3 nonprofit that simultaneously aims to educate and communicate initiatives to promote circularity, collaboration, and accountability in fashion. There have been a number of projects that TNFI has been working on recently, including a lecture series that became virtual with notable speakers. They've also helped to advance Remake Our World's Pay Up campaign, getting masks to organizations and businesses through Masks for Humanity, and educating consumers on the major legislative downfalls in the fashion industry. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Amelia. Great to be here.
So let's talk about your background in the fashion industry and how sustainability became a mega important issue in your life. So how and when did it all start?
Well, in terms of interest in fashion, that started really early. I've been a vintage lover for many, many years. I bought my first vintage purse at the age of 12. I have been pretty much shopped exclusively vintage for high school and college, really because of primarily budget issues. And then, but always loved the quality and craftsmanship of older pieces, which you can find sometimes in luxury goods, but really there's a way that things were made that sometimes, in terms of seams and all these details that you really just rarely see these days. So I had, that was sort of my background in terms of the industry and the making of clothing. And then I started in the industry. One of my first jobs out of college was at Cosmopolitan, which was ultimately a short stint. Publishing is, again, back to sort of budget. Publishing is a notoriously underpaid position. There's been some recent, I think, much more vocal opposition to, things like free internships or unpaid internships and all these things where it just functions to sort of limit who it is that can participate in that industry. And by that I mean specifically typically better off white folks are going to be in the publishing industry, or certainly were back when I graduated, which was 20 years ago. So, and I on and off worked in fashion. I had just a pull back to it. So I was had a lot of friends who were involved in different ways, and about in 2008, I actually started my own magazine with a couple of friends. So I was part of the founding team of a bilingual magazine in San Diego. 2008 not being a great year to start a magazine in terms of what was happening with the economy, but it was certainly a wonderful experience, and I really enjoyed it. And that's when I first learned about, quote, what was called green fashion. So people like Linda Loudermilk, who is a little less active today, but she was a bio silk proponent and made clothing out of LA. And there were a couple of smaller brands that were organic cotton and things like that. So that was back in 2008. And then I really came back to it about 3 years ago when I was working in IT, and I had an out-of-body experience in a meeting. It was a wonderful job, great opportunity, good team. In terms of a quote job, really fantastic in a lot of ways, but I just didn't feel emotionally connected to it. And that's a very privileged thing to say in a way, but it also was me just following my passion. So wanting to, get back into fashion. So I went back to FIT, started taking classes there, and that led me to find Fashion Revolution, which led me to find just the landscape of all of these really problem solvers that are trying to look at the layers of issues in fashion.
I like especially that you understood what quality meant in clothes, especially from such a young age, because that was not something that I really respected or cared about at all. I wouldn't say that my mom was very anti-fast fashion, just for like garment worker, you know, sweatshop reasons, and just the fact that like the clothes wouldn't last that long. And so she always, you know, she encouraged me to purchase better quality clothes. And so that was always something that I kept in mind, but it was never about the fabrics. I actually recently finished The Conscious Closet by Elizabeth Klein, and yep. I learned so much about the quality of our clothes and how to tell if something is good quality. And yeah. It just made me realize, you know, like what I was missing and what I'd been purchasing all these years was essentially a piece of crap.
Yes. And well, I mean, yes. Although I think there's been labor issues in fashion for, I mean, there's obviously the Triangle Fire, which is, you know, turn of the century, 20th century. And that's just a US centric example. There's been, once things started to move abroad, and really brands started to proactively seek out markets where garment workers were less protected. And they started to not want to own their factories. So they had plausible deniability about anything that would go wrong. I mean, that really was strategic to facilitate the owners making more and more larger, you know, margins. But yeah, it's, you know, there's also the proliferation of things like polyester, and I own some, you know, certainly did own some polyester pieces, and I'm still shocked sometimes to see that, because you can weave it in different ways and it can feel different. So you don't necessarily know that something is made of that. And I found, and I won't call out names, but you know, big brands, that have, you know, that are quote luxury, and they are selling a $500 or $600 dress that is polyester. And that to me is, I can't believe that exists personally, because polyester is, as you know, you know, made from oil, and it's just from end to end, it's a problematic, really bad fabric. I mean, ultimately I would love to see it banned actually. but yes, it's, you know, the cheapness and the sort of race to the bottom-ness of fast fashion is seen both in the fabrics that are used and the treatment of the workers. So
at what point, whether that be after working for Fashion Revolution or just a different experience that you had, made you realize that it was time to found your own nonprofit? So how did you come to that realization? And then also, how did you just take that leap?
Yeah, so it was in essentially wanting to do this work, committing to this work full time, and really wanting this to be a career move for myself. And so in order to do that, I needed to facilitate fundraising, which, you know, is, you can go a couple routes. You can certainly be, an LLC, or you can be a nonprofit. And I actually have both. So I do some consulting through the LLC, but I have the 501c3, for TNFI's work, because I also am fascinated by working with academia and by working with brands. So that were the landscape that I sort of was exposed to, via Fashion Revolution's, open source work. You know, it's really what they really have built is a platform, a social media platform for, information sharing and for people to have dialogue with the brand in terms of the who made my clothes and a couple of different, you know, things that they do. But I wanted to dig into more, okay, what are we doing in schools in the US? How can we facilitate more students knowing about these issues? Because there's a lot of environmental science students that will know, that actually aren't necessarily aware of this. So there's environmental science studies that completely gloss over the fashion industry. For the most part, they do. So it's not, you know, there isn't a lot of data about them. So you have these very eco-conscious people who are shopping either at like TJ Maxx, or they're buying polyester clothing, or they think that, you know, the recycled plastic bottle fleece that they have which I'm not necessarily scoffing at, but it's certainly not a Shangri-La or solution to the problems that we have in the fashion industry. And I think calling those pieces specifically, quote, sustainable is problematic overall, because I'm sure you may be familiar with the microfibers issue, but you know, you wash these things and they release plastic into the water, which is getting into our food systems, and we don't even know what kind of problems that's causing long term. So
especially since some research has found clothing made from recycled fibers, mm-hmm. recycled plastic fibers, and emit and release more microplastics when they're washed than virgin clothes made out of virgin materials, which I thought was really, really interesting.
Yeah. When you say virgin, do you mean, do you mean natural fibers, or you mean virgin, like poly?
Virgin polyester.
Yeah. 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 It is. I mean, I'm trying to think of who put out the article. I feel like it was either CNN or maybe NPR, but there was a piece about basically the fallacy of recycling in general, how we were kind of sold a bill of sale basically by oil companies about how recyclable plastics are. There are certainly, first of all, a lot of types of plastic containers. Cities don't have in the US specifically, don't have the infrastructure to support it. So you are sorting and you're sort of, there's a term called wish cycling, which I think is great, which is basically like you're hoping that it can be recycled, but it really can't. And, you know, it's not even necessarily getting, there's not necessarily the manpower to sort it at the source. It's not necessarily going to the machine that's going to, you know, recycle it. If it can be recycled once, that's maybe it, maybe twice. There's not infinite recycling of a lot of this packaging. So yeah, there needs to be, you know, more aggressive just banning, full stop, of all of this, which, you know, hopefully we can facilitate. I mean, we've had a hell of a time. We're finally getting people divesting from banks that support big oil. We're finally getting, you know, some VC companies that are saying they won't invest in that. We finally are getting people who want to really put their money where their mouth is against fossil fuel. But, you know, this is the new frontier for fossil fuel is fashion, are these fabrics. So we have to be really diligent to prevent them from getting a foothold again.
The two most common types of microplastics that are found in our waterways are from nylon fishing nets and clothes, mm-hmm. which is appalling. And things like, okay, so you mentioned the fabrics that are not infinitely recyclable. So that would be mainly polyester. Fabrics like nylon is a great example of a fiber that can be infinitely recycled. However, you know, what's the possibility that it's actually recycled? Probably not high. And metals like aluminum and glass, of course, are recycled plenty, but also, you know, only 8-10% of the single-use plastic bottles that are sold to people and people who use them are recycled. Only 8-10%. So we need to just start banning, because while awareness is increasing, that's not going to ultimately fix the issue. Like, governments need to understand how problematic this is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that you have, I mean, the EU has the ban coming, frankly, not soon enough, right? I think it's 2030 that they're banning single-use plastic. But you also have, I think you have the reality that a lot of people are realizing, which is the brands need to be pressured as much as the governments, because, you know, when somebody like Seventh Generation, which is under the umbrella of Unilever, but Seventh Generation is basically stepping back from plastics. I forget, it's a shorter timeline than 2030, but they're making, you know, they're going to put everything into aluminum containers. They're going to do, you know, use pods for everything. Like they've got a really aggressive, some really aggressive solutions. And then in the interim, you have brands like TerraCycle that are stepping in and they're saying, okay, if cities don't have the infrastructure for this, we're going to try to partner with, Selfridges and some other companies to try to capture and do something with cosmetics, plastics, for example. So brands are also needing to step up and step in, and they are. I think that they are because there's opportunity there. There's this whole landscape of what was considered waste that is a resource. I mean, I remember going into a meeting last October, so with a VC company, and pitching them essentially on the idea. So we were looking for funding as the nonprofit, and a lot of these larger companies in New York specifically, but they have huge numbers of money, tons of money. So trying to pitch to them that waste was the new frontier. It was the new frontier for making money. Like the gentleman, I mean, I'm still in dialogue with them. We'll see what happens long term, but he did not. It was such a different language than what they speak to talk about, recapturing value. They have such a linear, really specific way of thinking about things. And it is totally extractive. It's totally a lot of the language, because I actually worked in IT for a minute in with hedge funds, and it is just really aggressive language. It's interesting. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. And I think that the more females that we have in these spaces, frankly, the more holistic conversations we're going to have in terms of problem solving. And we also need to bring more perspectives into these conversations. So that's one of the reasons that we do the consortium program that we do, which is bringing together environmental science professors, labor rights professors, sustainability MBA programs, and then also fashion design professors, because these are kind of siloed ways of thinking. And these are, these are guides for future leaders, right? These are professors who are teaching students. We want them to be thinking in the round and talking to each other and facilitating just as much different kinds of problem solving as we can. I mean, it's really got to be combination of policy and brands making changes and, consumers knowing about these issues and pushing for change, and then voting with their wallets and not buying, either from brands that we know are not paying their garment workers or whatever it is. There's just a myriad of different stakeholders that all need to stand up and fix the problem, basically.
What's been the most moving thing that you've learned since creating the educational nonprofit, the New Fashion Initiative, and how did you use your platform to share the importance of that issue?
So moving, I mean, I just think that I am really inspired by Gen Z, by the younger generation. So we have a podcast project that we launched with a woman named Sophia Kiana, who runs a nonprofit called Climate Cardinals, and she is pushing to translate climate data and information into different languages to make it more accessible internationally. So she has, I think, over 5,000 volunteers to help translate. She's just building this incredible movement, and she just graduated high school, and she's just a freshman. I shouldn't say that. Sorry. But I'm 41, so I just feel in awe of it. So that is something that is endless inspiration for me. It's one of the reasons that I really love also, working with interns, because there's just I think we've got to stay hopeful, we've got to stay positive. We've got to be obviously more than just hopeful. We need to be super proactive and we need to be pushing for things. But in terms of approaching this work with a sense of purpose and joy, I find that working with younger people is constantly motivating for me. So that would be the main the main thing. And then in terms of the platform, it's interesting because I think that, you know, I am not really a social media person. So I personally have left Facebook. I am lackadaisical, probably at best, with with Instagram. I don't personally like to share a ton of my personal stuff. So, but it is undeniably this platform that is changing. It's sharing information. It's changing perception. It's giving, you know, people who didn't have a voice, all these things that are so important and empowering. And so I'm learning a lot in watching, in learning more about that, so that whole world, really, because it is a whole world. So.
Yeah, no, you're right. She's very young. And even though she's only a few years younger than I am, I was just trying to survive and get out of high school alive. And, well, I went to a very pressure cooker type environment growing up on the East Coast. And so it was very...
I went to a college school, so I totally know. Like, it was Ivy League or bust. It was intensely competitive. And, you know, and I hated that environment. I mean, I still have girlfriends from there, but, and a couple of really, you know, my best friend from kindergarten from there, but... you were sort of pushed to be competitive with each other in a really unhealthy way that I still have, like, there's still toxic remnants from that. And I'm, you know, and I also was a white female navigating that. I have friends who were African-American in that school and other ethnicities, although there really wasn't much more than that. And they had a totally different experience, and it was even tougher.
I agree with that. And it was something that if you had something different to share, or if you wanted to do something, you know, like it, you were just afraid to. You were afraid to do anything else because, you know, typical student government organizations and stuff weren't really my thing. And there was just no way to branch out. And so I'm glad that that young woman was able to find a place for herself.
Yeah, and I do, to go back to what we were talking about, I do think that social media is helping people find that. It's helping people find their voice and find their, you know, I hate to appropriate the term tribe, but, you know, they find their, they just find their community.
Posse.
Their posse, totally. Their people, their peeps, however you want to phrase it. And that is by them putting out their most, you know, intrinsic, their most vulnerable, their most honest self on this platform. And they are, and I think that there is certainly, there's a lot of negative aspects about it. And I have to say, I'm a jaded, being jaded, and I think slightly older, I sort of sometimes look at it and I only see those things. But there is a ton of, I think, really important community, you know, sharing and validation that happens that is super helpful and healthy for people. So I think that particularly for folks who are able to, I think, navigate it with some good, healthy boundaries and they have, you know, they've got to have the IRL support and community as well. But it connects dots and connects people in a way that we certainly didn't have before it, unlike anything.
What does it exactly mean to have a sustainable fashion nonprofit? So I get that you're able, that you're not able to lobby, that you can only educate individuals with the materials that they need to go out and so they can lobby government officials. What else should we know?
Well, it's, you know, it's interesting. I think there's been a lot more recent press covering these issues. There is, you know, the term sustainability is a very general, overused term that has been, you know, I think in many ways it's been watered down. It's been used by corporations that, you know, make, we were just referencing recycled fleeces. So they put out one jacket and they're calling themselves sustainable. But you know, that it's really still, I don't know what to know about it. I mean, it's just been fascinating to be in the space. I started in 2017, So I'd been in fashion on and off for many years, but I started learning about, you know, well, I started learning about it in 2008, as I said, when I was pulling for a shoot. And that's very superficial knowledge, just like knowing a bit that there were people who were really trying to do things differently and certainly produce less, have smaller collections, things like that. And I knew a little bit about slow fashion. One of my favorite designers is Maria Cornejo. So she's based in New York. And she is produces in New York, and she has a number of tenants, like, you know, themes or ways that she works that are small, slow fashion. But it's changed so much in the last 4 years. And I think there's incredible opportunity for us to push for change within the brands, and then also hopefully through some of the groups that are doing a lot with open source education, just educate consumers to be, I guess, policing, for lack of a better word, or just watchdogging brands to make sure that they aren't just making claims, you know, really looking behind the hood and kicking the wheels to say, like, okay, so, you know, because I don't think you can call yourself sustainable or circular if you aren't paying a living wage, right? That's kind of a basic thing, because that's a huge part of a brand, is providing for the workers who actually make the clothing. So if you're, you know, a lot of Made in USA, and you know Aisha from Remake, so she's done a wonderful job. I mean, her background is deeply in labor rights, having worked the UN and other groups, but she did a really fascinating documentary video about production in LA. And it's about the fact that you have a ton of garment workers here in the US that are paid piecemeal. So there's still a law on the books that you can pay like per sleeve, per, you know, neck, per pieces of like the sewing. So components of the clothing itself, instead of hourly. So you've got people really working under indentured servant, whatever term you want to use. Like, it's, you know, akin to like slavery, I think. And there are pockets of communities that aren't necessarily super strong, you know, with their English. So there's a lot of, you know, Latino immigrants in LA, and it's mainly Chinese immigrants in New York. Yeah, I think at the same time, you see progress, and you know, on the flip side of it, you just see, wow, there really is just so much that still is wrong. And I can't believe that it's 2020 and this is still happening. And people think, whether it's from some misguided patriotic sense of like Made in the USA, they think those are better. It doesn't mean at all that those are better labor conditions. In fact, you know, the New York garment district and the LA garment district have a lot of underhanded things that are happening. So there's a lot of people who are mistreated, and it's a learning process.
No, I'll include the Made in America film is really great, and I actually attended a Remake webinar where we watched the film at the beginning and then were able to chat with one of the garment workers that was featured in the film. Mm-hmm. As Remake has partnered with the Garment Worker Center, which I hope I will be interviewing soon for the podcast. But
They do such great work.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, SB 1399 hasn't been passed, but they're still making wonderful strides in helping workers know their rights and what they can and can't, you know, what they can do and what they're not allowed to do, especially in terms of organizing and forming unions and asking for higher wages and things like that. So... And Remake has a great, they have a bunch of different films they have made in Cambodia, made in Mexico, made in Nepal, a bunch of different ways to see what these different industries are and what they, you know, what they mean.
Well, yeah, I mean, to really see inside these factories. I mean, I think one of the realities of a lot of American brands and European brand and just brands in general is that you have a lot of, again, going back to the labor issues and the fact that people outsource to factories they don't own, they don't visit the factories. So you have people who've worked in the industry for, you know, however many years they've been in it, 10, 15, whatever, X number of years, and they haven't necessarily ever been to a factory. So they've never been to China to visit a factory. They've never been to Bangladesh or Cambodia. And now a lot of that production is being shifted to Western Africa to try to chase cheaper and cheaper labor. So it's a really important part of the conversation. And it's one of the reasons that we're focused really on looking at what the term circularity, which includes closed loop, which basically is everything from the design of the piece. Like let's make sure we're not making, you know, too much of any set of clothing, right? So whether that's 3D design or whether that's made to order, there's a few different models that you can go with, or we're certainly recapturing any textile waste and, you know, upcycling it or downcycling it into insulation, just making sure that there is end-to-end strategy behind the making of clothing. I think the old traditional model is hopefully, you know, permanently changed. We will not go back to it. I really am hopeful of that, but we'll see. I mean, we still have a lot of these large brands that need to be pushed from inside, and then also from outside, from consumers to not have business as usual.
Absolutely. And then I also want to touch on the impact that COVID has had, not only on these labor rights organizations, but also if it's shifted your focus at all throughout your career or in the new fashion initiative specifically, and how it's changed your focus. I mean, obviously the Pay Up campaign has been huge, but yeah, can you talk more about that and whether or not you've shifted more from an environment heavy to social justice based projects, and yeah, just how your work has shifted due to COVID?
I mean, I think what COVID highlights, which is what we're really focused on as an org, is just how interconnected everything is. You know, how we are. So COVID objectively is, you know, it shows how dependent we are on each other. So it shows how our actions affect other people. And that is, you know, why we have to wear masks, why we have to be staying inside as much as we can, why we really need to be mindful of being carriers to people who are more at risk. And that's a thinking and approach that really should be applied to every aspect of people's lives. I think I feel very strongly about that. So that has to do with, you know, respect, and that has to do with us taking, you know, just really thinking about consumption overall. So we're actually working, I'm excited to see, some work that we're doing about consumption patterns during COVID, and just to take a look at them, because I'm as you can probably tell from this conversation, I'm an eternal optimist. So that's just how I view the world. That's how I face things, especially when there's tough times, like there certainly has been with the pandemic, with a lot of the political stuff, with the fires. I mean, I'm out here in Seattle, so moved here about a year ago, and you know, we were inside last week for 5 days because of the smoke quality, and we weren't anywhere near as bad as Portland or San Francisco. So you had these huge swaths of the, you know, the West that were dealing with this fire and these millions of acres that were burning. And it's not even thinking about animals and other layers of things, and obviously people in their homes. But yeah, you've got to stay optimistic. And I think that you've got to share humanity is what we need to be focusing on, how, you know, what we have in common and how we can work together. So I think COVID just reinforces all of that for me, and makes it just an even stronger part of the work that we're doing. So that's how I would answer that.
Why has it been, just in general, I feel like this is a great question to culminate everything that we've talked about, why is it so difficult to get brands and government officials to care about the impact that fashion has on other people as well as the environment? It's a big question.
Yeah, reloaded. Question. I mean, there's certainly, I think, more than one answer. And there's more than, you know, there's more than one element to it. There's more than one factor. I mean, I'm going to say greed, probably, first and foremost. I think that we have a pretty broken political system. Well, I'll talk about political system. There's a lot of people who make a lot of compromises to get far in politics. So, which is not to say all politicians are bad. I think we've certainly got some great ones out there. But I just think that it's talk about a viper's sort of nest. I mean, I can't imagine working in it. Personally, I have friends who have worked on multiple, you know, campaigns for people going back. I mean, all on the Democratic side of things, but back many, many years, and just hearing stories of how that works, how crazy that can be is I don't know. I think there's a lot of I don't like CYA behavior. So it's really just, you want to take care of your own neck. And you're really in this like fight or flight mode kind of all the time, which doesn't promote, perspective or holistic thinking, or, I think really kind of ultimately long lasting problem solving. There's a lot of, reactive things that happen in policy. Also, there's a lot of compromise that happens in policy, because to get it, you know, because we have a bipartisan and we only have two parties, you know, things get really muddled by the time they actually get passed. So something can have a piece of legislation can have really high goals and or lofty aspirations, or however you want to say that. And then for it actually to become a reality, it gets, you know, you wouldn't even recognize it, like through however many steps or iterations it goes through. So, and those are really big systemic problems that I don't propose to necessarily have the solutions for. I think that COVID has certainly exposed, because people are less, quote, busy, because people have the humanity, I think, of having, a lot of people have their kids running around, which is a constant reminder of the future, of the challenges that we all face, again, back to shared humanity. So we're seeing traction with things that, frankly should have had more traction for generations. So like Black Lives Matter having a lot more, there's been a lot more activism around that. Now that's got to translate into more people, you know, of color in the Senate and in Congress. And I'm confident that November is going to be a turning point for good. I really, again, also need to think that way. That's it just is one of my coping mechanisms, to project and think positively about it, because I think we are going to galvanize people to vote and be engaged and get out there. And, but you know, it's time for, there to be, there's so many things that need to change in terms of, like, you know, capping fundraising for politics, enabling people who don't, you know, who aren't necessarily money to be a part of it. That's very important. And for there to be less lobbying. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to say that, you know, I'm not savvy enough to really know the solutions. I just know some of the problems, right? Or savvy, knowledgeable, whatever word you want to use. I just know that there are, again, a lot of young people who are pushing for change, and they're pushing, and they're voting, and they're galvanizing, like this group Plus One Vote, which I've been learning more about through one of our advisors, Thania Peck, and they are focused on Gen Z getting the vote out. And they've got some great traction and reach. And yeah, we need to, you know, I think it's almost less about wondering why they function the way they do, and more about, you know what, then let's just get them out of positions of power. If that's how they're functioning, whether it's a CEO or a politician, let's just, you know, apply pressure and find a way to replace them with somebody who thinks more holistically and in a, in a more holistic way.
I was laughing to myself when you would say some of those things, because it's just so true. Like, just kick them out. We don't need them. Yeah. They don't know what they're talking about. Yes, fingers crossed, November will bring about some change where people who know about their, you know, and have expertise in the areas in which they are in charge, and then also just making sure that this is really about views. This isn't about money. This is about what we and how people actually feel, rather than the, you know, the money aspect of it and just being thrown money at you to behave a certain way about something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm very much in a more socialist camp of a, probably should be so. Well, no, you know what? I'll be straightforward about my politics. I'm an open book like that. I think, you know, and I do think that there needs to be more. I think one of the reasons that you have in some of the countries in internationally, you have a high quality of life because you just have a lot of people who are at a comfortable level of money. You know, you have a living wage. You don't really have a living wage. Minimum wage is not a living wage in the US. That's a really basic issue. You know, if you've got to work 50 hours a week or 60 hours a week with minimum wage jobs to, you know, support yourself, that's not, you know, when rents are outpacing, you know, wages, that's a huge issue. That's not, you know, that doesn't promote a healthy society. So, I'm just hopeful that there are more people looking to address those kinds of issues. And there certainly are a lot of cities internationally who have solved for some of these problems in really creative ways. And again, a lot of times that's, you know, and I always forget the name of this city in Brazil, but there's a case study. And I had a classmate from FIT who actually was from this city in Brazil. They had an unemployment issue. They had a waste issue. And what they did was they created with like engineers and marketing people. They had this totally cross-disciplinary task force, essentially, that took the trash. So they took recycling from essentially barrios, you know, low income housing groups, and they took the trash and then they put that into, you could actually pay, you would get coins essentially, which you could use for public transportation, which would facilitate you coming into the center of the city to then find work. Like, they connected all these dots in such a wonderful way. I'll find it and I'll send it to you. I can't believe I'm forgetting the name of the city, but I read stories like that and I'm super hopeful. And I'm like, well, you know, it needs to be less about whose idea it was and just what works. Like, let's just use what works. If it's worked before, let's use it. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. Like, let's bring those same thinkers in and then have them meet with, you know, I don't know, just get as many smart people in a room as you can and try to leave the egos at the door and just get to the bottom of some holistic solutions. So.
Absolutely. And I'm reading the Naomi Klein book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. And I'm only, I don't know, maybe 40, 50 pages in. And I'm mind blown about what she's saying. It's that the far left understands, or the far right understands, the impact of climate change, and they understand the impact of racism. But what they also understand is that radical change is the only way to get that to happen. And that's why they're pushing back on it, you know? Like, who wants their society to completely, you know, they completely have to overhaul their entire, you know, way of knowing how the system works. And I get that. But you know, it's also about making people feel comfortable and making sure that they have much of a right to live and live about in a community as the rest of us.
See, and I think it's totally stimulating. I find the idea of resetting things fascinating. Like, bring on a totally new world. Bring on a different way of being. I mean, I think, you know, this is a small example, but it's a personal example that rewired my approach. I didn't shop for a year, right? And so I had, in terms of stress toolbox, right, we all have different things. Like, a lot of people have baths and meditation and these different things that are called different things. Sometimes it's talking with a friend, whatever it is, it's like a coping mechanism. Shopping was definitely a coping mechanism for me. So, and that would include vintage, but I did have a fast fashion moment in my like late 20s. And also brands that were like, that are kind of borderline where it's a little bit gray. They aren't necessarily low price points, but they don't necessarily have the best labor practices. So they have, they're not necessarily people that I would give my money to these days, but you should never be afraid of how differently you can do something, right? There's one approach that you've done and that's the way you've done it. You can always try something new. And that's something I think also starting my own business and navigating that world, which is very different every day. It's super hard some days. It's wonderful other days, but some days it really is, what am I doing? How am I going to do this? All those big questions that you wrestle with, but it also is, I don't know, that new frontier of possibility is pretty damn stimulating and pretty awesome.
My final question that I ask all my interviewees is, what is one issue that you feel, once tackled, will solve a multitude of the sustainability problems that we face in the fashion industry? And that can include environmental and social sustainability.
Yeah, that goes back to consumption, I think. You know, us realizing that we don't need so much stuff. So I think that's, again, another really powerful video for like, I'm a very visual person. So Story of Stuff has an incredible video, which I think is about maybe 15, 12 minutes long. Yeah, just that you don't need that much stuff. You don't need, you know, you don't need 18 pairs of jeans. You need, you know, need, and need is such a relative term, right? Think about that. Think about, you know, I think, yeah, consumption and how, why we shop emotionally, why we shop, looking at that, having really frank, conversations sort of with yourself about, are you buying for yourself? Are you buying to maybe peacock a little bit, you know, which I've certainly been guilty of. And I just do a heck of a lot less now. I mean, I will definitely dress in a certain way to feel confident for things. So it's clothing is definitely still an armor and kind of a part of strategy for things. And I think that's very important. It can be really emotionally supportive what you wear. But you know, it's not about shopping just to get and have and just loving what you already have and being creative with what you already have and being appreciative of what you already have. All of that is kind of tied into consumption habits, I think. And it will be, it's a long-term issue for people really to solve individually. Well, it's multi-tiered. The media factors into it too. I mean, there's, again, I think one of the challenges with fashion, the fashion industry, is that it touches on everything and it's layered and complicated. And so there isn't a silver bullet for any of this stuff, but I do think overall consumption is the main issue that we need to be facing.
I used to shop to fill a void. I would never really buy fast fashion just because, again, like, my mom was very anti-fast fashion, but we would buy from like Madewell, which is essentially the same thing. It's just priced higher. Mm-hmm. And so that's been something that I've been training myself not to do, because I love shopping, but I don't always need to walk away with something. You know, I have a list in my mind of mm-hmm. things that I need to round out my wardrobe. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, if Girlfriend Collective comes out with something, then of course I have to buy one of their sets. But beside the point, there's this...
They're based in Seattle, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. I want to interview them so bad, but they're like, oh, we're so busy. And I'm like, please, you're so cool. So one day, hopefully one day, I just have this list in my head of things that I need. Like, well, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, it was wonderful to chat with you. Great to meet you. And I think, you know, I am really inspired by the work that you're doing and how you are, you know, casting a wide net with the people that you're interviewing for your podcast. And I think that, you know, it's wonderful to put these issues out. Again, we've got to be talking about this to as many people as possible in as many different ways as possible so that we can create that paradigm shift that we need.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. That's all for this episode. Check out our Instagram and other social media in the show notes for all the resources we mentioned today. Listen to our other recent episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you typically listen. See you next week.